A little bit of history on Mary Neal. We were actually the first IONS group that Mary Neal ever presented to. We were very fortunate that I had been given some information about Mary and the book that she had just published, To Heaven and Back. And I understand there's a second book in publication right now as well. She and her husband are both orthopedic surgeons. They live in Jackson Hole. Mary and her husband, prior to moving to Jackson Hole, Mary was head of the orthopedic department at a large hospital in Los Angeles. Really a very highly respected orthopedic surgeon, really a great person. But anyway, a little bit of background on what happened to Mary, and then we'll get into the video, and why I think it's a very unique experience and why I believe it's helpful to our group is that because of her medical background, she offers another level of understanding that for those people that do not have the medical background and have had a near-death experience, don't have the benefit of. And so Mary can speak from not only the perspective of someone who had a near-death experience, but a physician who understood the physiological effects of what she experienced as a result of her accident. And so it makes it really very unique. And then there's another element of her experience, which we can talk about at the end of the meeting. I kind of want it to be brought out in the video. Very, very unique. And I can explain when we take questions and answers what I found really remarkable and unique about that aspect of her experience. I want you all to enjoy the video. At the end of the meeting, I want you to feel free to ask any of our board members any questions, either about Mary, her video. She's really a very special person. I'm sorry that we don't have her in person. Please feel free to ask any of our board members any questions that you may have at the end related to the video or general questions about near-death experiences. So I want to thank you all and welcome you, and we'll go ahead and get started.
We have all been uniquely and lovingly created in the image of God and called to live in fusion with Him and with one another. I'm Robert Ricciardelli, and welcome to The Converging Zone. Welcome to The Converging Zone. You know, not too many people get a chance to have a glimpse of heaven and then come back and talk about it. Our guest today, Dr. Mary Neal, has done just that. She's from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. She is a spinal surgeon. Welcome to the show today, Dr. Mary Neal. Mary.
Thank you. What a privilege.
It's great to have you here. It's great to hear your story. We've got the book, To Heaven and Back. Tell us about the story, the journey to where you went and what happened.
Well, my husband and I are avid kayakers. We've kayaked for years and years. And when my children were still young but were old enough for us to leave, we decided to go to Chile, to South America, and kayak with friends of ours who are professionals. They run raft and kayak trips all summer in Idaho, and then during the winter they run trips in Chile. So we went to Chile and had a wonderful time and loved the country and loved the people and kayaked all week. And what actually would have been our last day anyway, we had decided to kayak on a section of river that is well known for its waterfalls. And I don't mean crazy waterfalls. I mean drops of 10 to 15 feet, which may still sound crazy to a non-kayaker, but for a kayaker, that's something that is not unreasonable. Certainly challenging, but not unreasonable.
Is that considered level 5?
No, I've never been a class 5 boater.
Okay.
But definitely 4 plus.
Yeah.
And that morning, my husband actually didn't paddle with us. He woke up with terrible back pain, which he's never had before or after, but on that day he did. So he dropped us off at the put-in of the river, and then he drove off to find a nice place to read for the rest of the day, and he was planning on meeting us later at the takeout. So we put on the river, and at the time there were these friends of ours who are professionals and some other Americans, and I was with them, and we went over a couple of just introductory drops, and then as we approached the first big drop, we pulled off to the side of the river into an eddy and sort of discussed how we were going to run it, and we had decided to run the smaller chute. And a gal sort of bobbled past me, and she went into the chute, but she was sideways, and so the boat was sort of wedged between a couple of rocks, and she pulled her space skirt out and went downriver. I was already in the main current of the river, and when you're in the main current, it's not like you can turn around and paddle upstream. So I was committed, and I wasn't able to go down this smaller chute, so I had to veer off and go over the main drop. And as I went over the top of the waterfall, I could see the bottom, and there was tremendous flow, tremendous volume of water, tremendous force, and I could not see a clean exit or a clean outflow of water. And I knew I was going to have a little trouble. But I will say that my presumption was that I would hit the bottom, be flipped upside down, probably not be able to flip myself back up because of the turbulence, pull my spray skirt off, push myself out of the boat, be beaten up a little bit before I was spit out downstream. And that's an experience that is never enjoyable, but it certainly would not have been the first time I had been beaten up in a rapid. And I assumed that would happen. But when I hit the bottom of the drop, the front of the boat became pinned or stuck in the rocks and the underwater features. And I and my boat were immediately and completely submerged. And I'm a spine surgeon, as you said. I'm used to high stress situations. I'm a very calm person. And so I didn't panic. It wasn't the first time I'd been underwater in my boat. But I tried to rock the boat, and I tried to pull my spray skirt off. I tried to do anything I could think of that would either extricate the boat or extricate me. And it became clear very quickly that nothing I was doing was making a difference. And I'm a very pragmatic person. I knew nothing was working. I knew I was too far from shore for anyone to come and get me. And I have seen people drown in the river before. And so I knew that even if they could get to me, the likelihood of their actually being able to pull me out of the boat was pretty slim. And at that point, I made a very conscious choice after first being a little disappointed in myself for getting myself in this situation. But at that point, I asked that God's will be done. And it was certainly not the first time in my life that I have asked that. I think it's pretty common. I was raised in a church, and while I wouldn't have claimed to be overly religious, I would have claimed to be a Christian, and I've certainly said the Lord's Prayer plenty of times. But there was a qualitative difference. Oftentimes, I think most of us, certainly me, pray the Lord's Prayer and ask that God's will be done, but we don't really mean it. We want it to be done as long as it's in line with what we want to have happen. And I think that that was probably the first time when I asked that God's will be done, and I truly meant it, regardless of the outcome, and I gave up trying to control that outcome. And the moment I asked that, I was immediately and absolutely overcome with a very, very physical sensation of being held and comforted and reassured that everything was fine. My husband would be fine, my four young children would be fine, regardless of whether I lived or died. And
so you actually completely surrendered at that point. We talked about.
I did.
You surrendered.
It was a very active process. It wasn't a process of giving up. It was a very active choice of giving over control. And we went through a little bit of a life review, and it wasn't so much of a life review in terms of looking at an event and judging it. it was actually very profound because it was looking at events in my life, not in isolation, but looking at how they not only impacted the world and my environment, people two or three times removed, but really looking at how it had an impact 25, 30, 35 times removed, which was one of the profound aspects of this experience for me, because to realize that every event, every action, every decision, every human interaction has consequences. 25, 30, 35 times removed changes the way you view every moment of every day. And I was still aware of my circumstances.
So at this point, how many minutes in do you think consciously you can remember?
Oh boy.
It's hard to say.
I don't know. It was a very different sense of time.
Are you removed from time, you think, at that point of surrender? Or?
Well, certainly things change, and all sense of time and dimension change. Because at that time, I was still aware of my circumstance. I could feel the water, I could feel the current, I could feel the current slowly pulling my body out of the boat. My little thought balloon off to the side, and again, I'm a very pragmatic, sort of cynical person, and I was looking at all this thinking, this is really strange. I knew that I had been underwater too long to be alive, but I felt more alive than I've ever felt.
Did you feel like you couldn't breathe, or what was the...
I never had a sense of air hunger or panic or fear, despite the fact that I grew up fearing a drowning death. And I don't know why. I'm a water person. I always have been. But when I grew up, I was always the person that said, well, I don't care how I die as long as I don't drown. I always thought it would be horrible. But the fact is that it was wonderful. I felt wonderful and alive, and I could feel my body being pulled over the front deck of the boat. And as it did that, of course, that's fine when it comes to your hips. When it comes to your knees, I could feel my knees bend back on themselves, and I could feel the bones breaking, ligaments tearing. And as an orthopedic surgeon, I thought, oh, that's probably my tibial plateau. And again, this little thought balloon off to the side kept thinking, well, I wonder if you're just not aware. I wonder if you're screaming and you have pain, but you just don't realize it. And so I would keep doing these little self-assessment exams, and no, I really didn't have pain, and I really didn't have fear. And as my body was coming out of the boat, I could feel my spirit peeling away from my body, sort of like peeling apart two pieces of tape. And then I finally felt my body break free from the boat. And when that happened, I could feel my spirit rise up and out of the river. And I was immediately greeted by a group of people, beings, spirits. I'm never really sure what to call them because those words mean different things to different people.
Kind of human form?
They did have a physical form, head, arms, legs. They were wearing these robes of sorts and were very brilliant so that the edges were not absolutely distinct. But they were absolutely overjoyed to greet me and welcome me and love me and I them. And I knew, and when I use that word, no, it's a very different sense than the way we do.
Yeah.
I mean, I can say that I know this couch is leather, but that would be very different than being the person who actually raised the cow and slaughtered the cow and took the skin and did whatever you do to make leather and made a couch. I would know that that couch was made of leather and there'd be no room for discussion. And that's really the sense of knowing. I knew that these people or beings were there to greet me and guide me and protect me. I knew that they had been sent by God, were of God. And it was so joy-filled. I mean, now, of course, I wish I'd looked at them very carefully and said, gee, you know, who are you? Are you my grandfather?
Yeah.
And it's hard to describe, but at the time, there was a lot going on, and they were taking me down this exceptionally beautiful path toward this great dome structure of sorts that not only was exploding with beauty and color, but the absolute purity of God's love. And I could hardly wait to get there. I knew that that was essentially the entrance to heaven, to God's kingdom, whatever term you want to use. And I could hardly wait to get there. So when I looked at these people, it was almost as though, well, okay, there's plenty of time to chit-chat later. Let's get going.
Let's move it. Yeah.
And there was this different sense, again, of time and space. And I was able to be with them and travel down this path and simultaneously look back at the scene on the riverbank. And by this point, my body had been sucked out of the boat and taken downstream. And I was able to watch as one of the guys, actually my body bumped into him, but he grabbed my wrist and I watched as he pulled my body over to the shore, and then they started CPR. And this guy was a young man at the time, he was only 18, and he's one of those guys that sort of, well, he's like a Labrador puppy. He's loving and innocent and vulnerable, and he kept calling to me to come back and please take a breath. And I would eventually be so overcome with compassion for him because he seemed so vulnerable that I would interrupt our progress and go back and take a breath and then leave, because all he asked was for one breath. And then he would start calling and the same thing would happen. And the cycle went on multiple times.
But there was nothing in you that wanted to go back.
I was
stay.
Really surprised by a couple of things at that point, because I did claim to be a Christian before this event, and I sort of hoped that there was life after death. I can't say I really spent much time thinking about it, and I didn't really have any preconceptions. And at that point, I was really surprised by two things. One is that as I look back at my body and look back at the guys doing CPR, I had no desire to return. I wasn't coming back. And don't get me wrong, I have a great life. I had a great life. I love my husband. I love my children more than I could ever imagine loving something on earth. But all of that paled in comparison to God's love.
Wow.
And I was absolutely overcome with the sense of being home, of being where I really belong, truly belong.
Peace for the others.
Well, I had been reassured that they would be fine. And so...
Not a spoken voice, kind of a... How was God communicating to you?
Well, I believe that when I was still on the boat, that Christ was holding me. And that's something that I didn't talk about for a long time. And actually, when I first wrote the book, I didn't really identify him specifically because it seemed very presumptuous, out of context. I mean, who am I? And that actually was one of the first incredibly profound aspects of this for me, because what I realized was, yes, Christ was holding me, but the fact is Christ would be holding any one of us if you ask. And that was profound. And the communication wasn't talking like we're talking. And I don't like the word telepathy because it sounds a little too woo-woo or something.
But there's a knowing.
But there's an absolute purity of communication. And it, as I look back on it, really allowed me to understand the whole idea of the Tower of Babel. God doesn't have to speak in English or any other language. It's this very pure sense of communication. And so we were making progress, but it was sort of the idea of three steps forward and one step back. And it was interesting to talk to this fella after the fact, because we were each both really irritated with the other for very different reasons. But eventually we did get down this path. And there was sort of this threshold, and I could see inside, and there were many other angels, spirits. Again, I'm not quite sure what to call them, but they were all very busy. And I knew they were all busy doing God's work. I don't know what it was, but they were all very busy. And I could hardly wait to cross that threshold. I was kind of, I wanted to just dive across.
What was this, when you talk about these people with you, now going back and thinking about it, do you think they were angels, or do you think they were part of the cloud of witnesses that
were
crossing dimensions?
I don't think they were angels. I think that they were, and again, I don't know whether to call them people or beings or spirits. I believe that they were spirits, as was I at that point.
Family, maybe?
I think that they were people. I knew that I had known them as long as I existed. And I knew that they had known me and loved me as long as I existed. I think had I taken the time to actually look at them, I probably would have identified them as particular people.
Yeah.
But I didn't take the time. And I do think that it's more along the lines of this cloud of witnesses. You know, it's like the cheering section, saying, all right.
And they're actually ushering you in.
Yes.
What a beautiful...
Well, and I absolutely believe that God sends his most gentle messengers to greet you and welcome you and guide you. And I did know that they were there to protect me. And I've been asked, from what? And I don't know that. I only know what I know. I don't pretend to know what I don't know. And so, yes, I think, as I look back on it, I think they were basically people, spirits.
Yeah.
And I think what I saw inside, I call them spirits. I don't know. I wouldn't say angels, but that's my own interpretation. I don't know. But that was another incredibly profound part of this experience for me, because as I was on the threshold, and I don't have the vocabulary to explain how it works. It's sort of like trying to describe a three-dimensional world with two-dimensional language. It's just not there. But it was profound because it was at that point that it became very clear to me how it can be true that God actually knows each one of us, loves each one of us as though we're the only one, and has an incredible plan for our lives. And that to me was very profound because it's something I had struggled with a little bit beforehand. How can God know each one of us? There are billions of us. And certainly how can he love each one of us when we struggle to love the people in our neighborhood, the people that don't look like us, don't agree with us, don't share what we think is important. I think it's so difficult for people, including me, at the point to love. But it was incredible. And I can't tell you how it works, but I can reassure you that it really is true.
You experienced this.
I experienced it,
absolutely.
It's not
a theological concept. No. This is real.
It was real and absolute. And then a point came when there was this sense of disappointment that sort of descended on everyone, and I was told that it wasn't my time, that I had more work to do, and that I had to go back to my body.
And this was, again, same type of communication, not verbal?
Right, it wasn't verbal.
Right.
It was this pure sense of communication or understanding. So I did what I thought was most reasonable at the time, which was say, no, I'm not going back. I'm here, you can't make me. But of course, they can make you. And so I was given some information at that time about some of the reasons, some of the work I still had to do. And then we went back down this same path. And this path was so beautiful. And it was as though I could not only see it and appreciate the beauty, but it was something I could taste and hear and experience it. It's a very strange thing. It was though it was all colors simultaneously, but their essence. Now, here on Earth, you mix all the colors and you get brown. But that was a different sort of thing. And so then we went back and I laid down and then I was reunited with my body. I won't say I was happy about it, but there I was.
What did you feel at that moment when you came back into your body? I mean, can you remember
that
part?
I couldn't believe that, as my kids would say, I was kicked out of heaven. I just couldn't believe it. And I was in that state for many months. I was, for the first 2 or 3 weeks, in a state really of feeling like I had 1 foot in this world and 1 foot in God's world. And for example, I had multiple broken bones, multiple orthopedic injuries, but I didn't have pain for almost 2 weeks. I had absolutely no pain.
Even when you went into your body at that moment, there was no pain.
I had no pain.
Still were. What do you think that was? Because you're a doctor.
I don't really know. All I can ever really come up with is the statement that where medicine and science ends, God begins. But I don't know. I really feel like I was truly still neither here nor there. And I really can't explain it. But I've gone back and looked at my medical records because I just thought, this can't be true. And even when I was in the ICU, I had another out-of-body experience, and I had some other miracles occur during that time. And I'm a cynic. I went back through my medical records because I really thought, no, I was being given some really great narcotics or some medication that would explain things away. But I really wasn't. Other than antibiotics, I didn't receive any.
What was the diagnosis of all the injuries? And it'd be nice to hear what those are. And then I'd like to hear about some of these episodes you had while you're still in this state, kind of here, there, sure, in your mind and your spirit. That's interesting.
Well, it's funny because I had tibial plateau fractures. I had basically tore all the ligaments except the ACL. It was the only thing holding each knee together. So I had massive injuries all around my knees. And this is the part of the story that I'm never proud to talk about, and it's embarrassing to say the least because it doesn't make sense. But afterward, I decided I was going back to Wyoming for medical care. And I decided, because we already had our commercial flights lined up, that we were just going to fly home. We even have coverage for medical evacuation. I mean, none of that makes sense. There's no rational explanation except that there was no one in that environment who would tell us that we were crazy. Because everyone we were with looked to us to make medical decisions. And my husband was in absolute state of shock. Yeah. And so.
And your husband's a doctor too.
He is. He's an orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah.
And so he made splints for my legs and we started flying home. And it's not something I would ever encourage or recommend to anyone else. And so by the time we did get back to Wyoming, I had a horrific case of ARDS, or this acute reaction in your lungs after any sort of shock. And at that point, the internist met us in the emergency room and basically told my husband at that time that I wasn't going to make it. And then I was in the ICU, and again, I was in a state of not caring, really. I
Peace.
Didn't want to be here anyway. So,
how long were you actually under the water?
Well, if you talk to the people who resuscitated me, they would say it was about 30 minutes. I tend to focus on about 15 minutes because it was very confusing. With a waterfall, if you're down below, you can't see the boaters on top. And if you're above, you can't see below. And when people have a problem, you almost always see a boat or you see a kayaker in the water, but both aren't missing. And so when this happened to me, the boat and I were both missing. And so it took them a while to figure out that we were both missing, that we were neither up nor down. And once they realized that, then it took them a while to figure out where I might be, because I was about 6 or 8 feet under the water. And so they couldn't see the boat, they couldn't see me, they didn't really have any indication. Once they identified where they thought I was, then they started to watch, because as I said, they're used to water rescue. And on the watch was 15 minutes. Mm. So I tend to focus on 15 minutes because that's very concrete. They would readily say that, no, actually it was more like 30. And the importance of that for me is that it takes off the table any of the rational explanations. When I came back, I spent many months trying to really think about these experiences that I had and come up with a reasonable explanation. I'm a scientist. I did believe in God, but at the same time, you know, there must be a reason and a reasonable explanation. And so I, of course, thought about dreams and hallucinations, but those are two explanations that really have no bearing on this conversation, because the quality of the experience is totally different. The memory of the experience is totally different. Anyone who's had a near-death experience or an experience involving God would say the same thing, which is that I remember the details as accurately and precisely today as if it were happening real time. And that's true even if the event happened 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
It's an imprint, right, isn't it?
It's so different. I have many people in my office ask for a few more minutes to tell me their own story. And I practice in Wyoming. Some of these are, you know, kind of old-time ranchers. They are not touchy-feely kind of people. And they'll go on to tell me their story, and it's always the same, which is that I remember this as though it's happening right now. And so dreams and hallucinations really weren't a reasonable explanation. So then I thought, well, okay, it's probably just the abnormal firing of the brain and basically the chemical death after being without oxygen. And that's why the time is important, because the human brain hangs on to oxygen for about 6 minutes. And so if you sort of think about, okay, 6 minutes, and then 2 or 3 minutes of dying and firing and chemical release, well, that brings us up maybe to 9 minutes. So, okay, give it a couple of more minutes. That still doesn't add up to the time I was without oxygen.
Yeah.
And so at some point, you have to say, well, no. Those really don't explain it. And this is beyond what science can document.
It really was God.
It was.
Was Christ.
Absolutely. And the thing that's been interesting to me to think about over time, because this is now 12 years, 13 years, and I think the question really should be reversed. Because the question really shouldn't be, why believe my story, why believe someone else's story? It's really the opposite, because there are hundreds of thousands of accounts of near-death experiences that share similarities. They occur over cultures and faiths and ages, and they're all so similar. Mm. They all have similar components. Most of them talk about beauty, albeit differently. I like the mountains, maybe you like the desert. We see beauty differently, but we can still experience beauty. Mm. I personally have never met a single person who actually wanted to come back. I've met a couple of people who made a decision or made a choice, were given a choice, and they made a choice to come back for particular reasons, but even they didn't really want to.
Wow. Well, Mary, this is incredible. I'm thankful that we're actually going to be able to see you again on another episode. Welcome to the Converging Zone. We've got a great show today. We've got back with us Dr. Mary Neal, the spinal surgeon who went to heaven and came back. She's the author of a book, To Heaven and Back. Welcome to the show today, Dr. Mary Neal.
Thank you.
Mary, welcome back.
Thank you.
Boy, we had such a good time on episode one. If you guys haven't seen it, you got to see it. But so many questions that I have come up, you know, about your experience that I think the audience would find fascinating. You know, one of the questions that came up initially was, you know, we talked about the 15 minutes that you know was recorded, but most likely 30 minutes that you were gone, checked out, mm-hmm. with the heavenly presence, with the presence of God. Talk about this resuscitation. We talked earlier about these experts that you've talked in the field about resuscitation efforts that normally don't succeed. Talk about that.
Well, it was interesting because I thought, well, you do CPR and that works and there it is. And I will say that even as a physician, I've thought that CPR is pretty effective in the field. And what I've come to realize is that it really isn't. Last summer, we were doing some filming in Idaho, and the producer was interviewing the guys who resuscitated me. And the dad of the group has been doing this for 30 years. And she asked how many times he's been involved with water rescue, water recovery, water events. And he thought about it and he said, well, I don't really know, but at least a couple of hundred or more. And the follow-up question to that was really interesting to me because I'd never thought about it. And she asked him, how many of those have been successful? And he said, well, that's easy. One, mine.
Wow.
And they are the first people who step back and say that they have nothing to do with it. They were physically the ones doing the resuscitation, but they don't feel like it was their doing at all. They absolutely believe that this was God's doing. And it's interesting because even in the field outside of water rescue, CPR actually isn't that effective, which wow. is surprising.
Yeah, because you'd think there'd be a lot more successes on that.
Right.
Now, this happened in 1999.
Yes.
Right? And you wrote the book just a few years ago.
I just wrote it last year.
Last year. What took so long to write the book? Why did it take so long to write the book?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's a question that many people have asked. And the answer is pretty simple. Number one, in my defense, my children were very young, and I felt that my not wanting to return was an important part of the story. And I never wanted them to think that they weren't enough of a reason for me to return. And so I really didn't talk about it because I didn't want them to overhear me saying that. So I do think that's a legitimate reason.
Yeah.
But the real reason is that I really didn't want to do it. I am a spine surgeon, mother, wife. I am active in terms of sports. I didn't have the time. I didn't have the desire to write. And indeed, writing is something I knew was expected of me. And it certainly is a very efficient way to share my experience with other people, which I knew was one of the prime mandates for my return. But my world and the publishing world had absolutely no overlap. And I really just didn't want to do it. And so I came up with all sorts of great excuses and rationalizations why I didn't need to do it and didn't want to do it. And one day in 2009, it was as though God picked up my bed and threw me out and said, Now is the time you are going to do this. And I will say that from that point to this, it has been an incredible journey of obedience. And I got up and I wrote. and I would get up at 4 a.m. and I would write for several hours until it was time to get the kids up and do the whole morning routine. And I was absolutely compelled, and I just sort of poured it out and wrote the whole thing in about a week. And at that point said, okay, good, I'm done. And then I sort of came back to it and said, no, you know, it was this sense of, no, you're not done, finish it. Like, truly finish the job. And I did, and I finished what I felt was the final manuscript several hours before my oldest son was killed. And his death was something that I had been told about, not precisely when it was going to happen or how it was going to happen, or even that it was absolutely going to happen, because although God does have a plan for our lives, and I believe that we come here with an outline of that plan, there are branch points. Plans change, and God can do it, change things as he wants.
Yeah.
And certainly, I had hoped that the plan for my son had changed. And people have asked many times, well, how could you possibly go through your life knowing that you're going to lose your son? And my response is pretty straightforward. Number one, of course, I hope the plan would change. But secondly, I had an absolute trust that the promises of God were true.
You were prepared for it.
I was absolutely prepared, not only because I had been told about it, but really the importance was having made this transformation from faith that the promises are true to an absolute and complete trust that God's promises are true. And some of those promises involve the fact that there is a plan for each one of our lives, and that is a plan that is one of hope and has a future. And I knew without doubt, without any questioning, that if indeed the plan was for my son's death, that there would be great beauty in his death. Remember, I had already seen in my own life how an event had this unseen ripple effect 35 times removed. And I knew the same would be true with my son's life and his death if it occurred.
And you know, it's interesting, I was reading the book, that even your son had a knowing that his life would not go into the 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s.
He did. He actually told me when he was very young, 4 or 5, that he wasn't going to live to be 18. And when he had said that to me, he said it in a way that absolutely hit my very core. And I never forgot that. And so when I was kicked out of heaven and told about the expectations of my role when he died, it didn't come as a surprise. And perhaps that's why I was able to listen to what they had to say and take it to heart, instead of responding with, what?
Yeah.
But I absolutely believe that God's timing is perfect.
Yeah.
And even though I spent all those years justifying why I didn't write this book, I actually believe that God's timing is perfect. And by finishing the manuscript just before his death, I was able to really fulfill those expectations of me at that time. And I'm not sure that would have been true earlier. I had been very protective of how much I allowed myself to really think about and experience my memories, because it's very alluring. You know, it's very alluring to think about heaven and the future. But the fact is, we all have work to do
in the
right
now.
Here, right now.
Yep, yep.
And we need to be about that business. You know, we can't be spinning our wheels and, you know, off in la-la land.
That's good.
So I actually think that it was great, because when I wrote the manuscript, I allowed myself to not only remember everything in detail, but fully re-experience that part of my life. And it allowed me to really respond appropriately at the death of my son and really help other people see God in it and see the beauty.
Well, I see the timing of the book as perfect, such as you, because you talked about ripple effects. And a lot of the ripple effects, if you would have wrote it earlier, wouldn't have been able to be told.
Right.
Because you were able to bring in what's going on up until today because of what happened.
Yes.
So I think that's another reason why the timing was perfect. That's great. So tell us some about those ripple effects. Talk about some of the ripple effects of what happened and how that extended into your family and to your friends that experienced this with you and others.
Well, I can talk about that, but I would tell you, I think the most profound effect are ones that I'll never know. When I think back on my life, and I'm sure the same is true of yours, you can recall events or people who said things to you that had an impact that was way out of proportion to what it should have had. And I feel like that's actually the biggest thing. And I've had the privilege of having feedback from many people who have said, gee, I heard your story, or now I've read your book, or I knew your son, and let me tell you how it changed my life. And that is an incredible privilege. And that's why I don't feel at all bad promoting this book, because I really don't feel like it's my story.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm the one living it, but I really feel like it's God's story, and God is using it to inspire people to find God in their own lives. And that's really my goal in all of this, because I believe that you can't have it, you can't have faith by association. Yeah. You know, people have faith because they grew up in a family that had faith, or they have friends who go to church, or they go to church and they're around people who say they have faith. But so many people have what I call sort of faith by association. It's not deeply rooted, and it's not part of their daily life and part of what they truly are. And what I hope is that by reading this book or by hearing my story, people are inspired to say, I'm going to look at my own life. Yeah. Let me look at my life and see the ways that God has loved me, guided me, protected me. And I believe it's only when you really see God working in your own life, and I believe anyone who looks will find God working in their life, but I think it's only when you see God actually working in your own life, not someone else's, that you make this incredible transformation from faith to trust. And I think when you make that transformation, then it changes everything.
It's a game changer.
It's a game changer because you have to get to this point where you don't need any more proof. You know, we all want a little more proof and a little more proof and a little more proof. But the fact is, at some point, you have to look at everything and say, I'm good. I commit. And when you do that, and part of that is accepting that, you know what, not only is there life after death, but all the promises are true. Then it changes the way you experience every moment of every day, because everything really matters. Everything really is part of God's plan, not only for your life, but God's plan for the world.
You know, what's interesting is you were that person that you were talking about that you're trying to reach before you experienced this.
You were
one of those people that said, yeah, I have a little bit of experience, I believe, but it was like not really a participation.
Right, I would agree. I took my kids to church, and I think I was really typical because I, of course, wanted to be a better parent than my parents had been to me. And I did take my kids to church, and I tried to make them understand that it's more than just a Sunday morning sort of thing. But despite making these repeated commitments to say, okay, no, I'm going to start really integrating it into our family life, you know, you get to the end of the day and after you've taken care of all the details of daily life, you're tired and you failed again.
Yeah.
And I think that is really, really common. Or you think about your spirituality as this part of what you are, instead of it really is what you are and everything else comes out of it.
Integration of all of life.
Right, a total integration, even prayer. You know, I will say that before this experience, I had this idea of prayer that it was something that, okay, I set amount this part of time and I pray, and or I read the Bible, but it's this little blocked out period of time, this segment of my life. But I would say that now, rarely do I set aside time to pray. I feel like I'm in constant prayer. I feel like my life is a prayer, and I feel like what that really means is that I am constantly listening and I'm constantly trying to obey. And it's really been an incredible journey of obedience, an incredibly exciting, wonderful, adventurous journey of obedience, because God really does have a plan that is one of hope. Yeah. Even writing this book, I had this idea that, okay, well, I'm supposed to write the book, so I'll write it, and then a publisher will come knocking on my door, and there it is. Yeah. Check off the list. You know, I don't have time for this sort of thing. And it was an incredible journey for me, because at each point in time when I said, well, I don't have any idea how I'm supposed to get to the next step, I would say, well, okay, God, you want this done? Let's have it. Yeah. Put someone in my life. And someone would show up. And then I finally came to the end of that process, and it was time to publish it. And I said, well, okay, I'm waiting for the publisher to call, not knowing that that doesn't happen. And so I was very frustrated one day, and I said, well, this is ridiculous. You know, if you want this published, you need to do something about it. Got in my car, turned on the radio, and it came on really loudly to this Christian music station, and it came on to the refrain of a song that said, I refuse to wait for someone else to do what God has asked me to do myself. Mm. And the beauty in that for me was, in this journey of obedience, my response was not to turn the station. My response was, oh, really? And I followed through with it.
Yeah. And we're thankful you did, because it's a wonderful book and it will bring hope to those who read it. You know, what was your view of, I was thinking about your view beforehand of heaven. What was that view versus what is your view today? And we've talked about what your view is today, but I'm kind of curious of how much it changed between what your perspective was prior.
I don't really think I spent much time thinking about it.
Hmm.
I mean, I
just knew it existed.
Hoped that there was life after death, and I believed that there was something more. But I don't think I spent a lot of time thinking about it, because as I've said earlier, I am very pragmatic, and I recognize that no one knows what it really is.
Yeah.
And so I don't really think I had any preconceptions.
Mm. Your children, since you've right, you know, you told them the story, I think, as they grew and they heard some of the story. How has that formed who they are today, maybe in your relationship with Bill and, mm-hmm. and all that? How's that unfolded?
I actually didn't tell them most of it because, as I said, I think that not wanting to come back was an important part of it. But it certainly influenced the way I parented. I mean, spirituality and being obedient to God and thinking about following Christ's lead was part of every breath. I mean, it's what I am. And that certainly influences how I parent. it certainly influenced how I parent with regard to cherishing every moment with them. I came back with this understanding that my oldest son would probably die young, and I cherished every moment with each of my kids. With my husband, it was interesting because for him, it was a very different experience. He often said that I was off talking to God, but he was changing diapers, which is true. He was very busy and put one foot in front of the other, and it was a very emotional time for him. He's a guy, and he had very typical guy reactions. One of the overriding emotions for him at that time was this sense of failure, because he did not protect me. And the role of a guy is to protect his family. And so it was very difficult for him to actually talk about it. And I will tell you that he did not hear the whole story until the manuscript was going off to the publisher. And I handed it to him and I said, okay, this is my life and therefore our life. So if you want veto power, you need to read this. But it was very emotional for him. And reading about our son's death was very difficult for him.
Yeah.
But it has certainly changed the way that he experiences his spiritual life. Certainly with my children. They know it's real. They know I'm not a very creative person. They know I'm not fanciful and creative, and they've made fun of that my whole life.
You're a pragmatic mom.
I am. And so they know me, and therefore they know that everything I have told them is true.
What can you say to the audience that's out there? There's a lot of people out there, not just in this country, other countries, that that are going through tough times. They're going through challenges. What can you speak to them about your experience and how they can maybe experience that without having to go through what you went through?
We all face challenges. That is the nature of being here on Earth. And I will say that I don't like challenges, but I embrace them. And through those challenges, I still maintain an absolute sense of joy, because I know, first of all, that whether I can recognize them or not, there really are beautiful ripple effects. But the other thing is that nobody ever changes when things are good. When things are good, who wants change?
Yeah.
It's not a surprise that typically we turn to Christ or we turn to God when we're on our knees, when we've been knocked down. And it's only during those times of challenge that people really grow and change and hopefully develop their spiritual life. You know, you can look at things throughout history and see the beauty in them. You can go back as far as Christ. I mean, that's a guy, doesn't even matter who you think Christ was, whether he's a son of God, prophet, man, it doesn't matter. That's a person who was betrayed by a best friend, arrested, beaten, humiliated, and murdered.
For doing good.
Yeah, and that if that's something that happened today, of course it'd be all over the internet, all over the newspapers, we'd all be talking about it and wringing our hands. But the fact is, all these years later, we celebrate it. Even at the time, you know, his disciples were moping around, talking about how horrible it was. Well, we see our challenges from a very narrow perspective.
That's good.
And I really feel like you have to look at your life and make this transition into an absolute trust in order to truly look at challenging circumstances with a sense of joy.
That's good.
And I believe you can.
Which is the promises are assured in Christ.
Absolutely.
And I love that idea, because God is in the darkness. He's in the challenge as much as he's in when we're winning the ball game.
Absolutely.
That's wonderful. Now, what about this? This is interesting. You have a great story for those of a faith, but also you have a story about this God, this Christ, who loves, who loved you in that boat, not because of your performance, not because you went to some church service prior to say a prayer and all these things that you would think you had to do, or we've been taught many times you have to do, right. But you felt the tangible presence of God, of love around you. Your story, I believe, is going to send a message to those who've never even maybe even heard of Christ.
Right.
Because of this experience. Talk about that, about this story, this message, getting to those that maybe have no framework of this God, this Christ.
Well, the fact is, whether people like it or not, God loves each of us on this planet as much as He loves me. And I may not like it. There are people I don't care for. Now, I will say that that's changed quite a bit since this experience. I truly try to see people the way God sees them. But the reality is there are people that, whether it's me or anyone else, you don't like, and you don't want God to love them because, for whatever reason. But the fact is, God created each of us and loves each of us dearly. And I think that reading my story can inspire people, again, to look at their own lives. The person who can get in the way of God's love is themselves. I mean, one of God's promises is that nothing can separate us from God's love. Mm. And I absolutely not only believe that's true, I know it's true, except I would put the little asterisk on the side. There is someone who can get in the way, and it's us.
It's us.
We don't feel lovable. We don't feel like God can forgive us. We don't feel like we've done enough. We're not good enough. And we just have to get out of the business of judging, which is what we're doing, whether it's judging someone else or whether it's judging ourselves. Mm. It's not our job.
Yeah, it's good.
We have jobs to do, and that is
not one of them.
That is God's job. And if you could get to the point where you get out of the business, you know, focus on...
Get out of the judging business.
Exactly. Focus on doing what you're supposed to be doing and get out of the business of judging. I think it'll go a long way toward not only allowing each person to develop their relationship, but it'll go a long way toward inspiring someone else to turn and seek God's face.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it may be that you or I or whomever is the only experience or the only exposure that someone has to a loving God.
Yeah. So basically, audience, your ripple effect of your life goes much further than you can ever see. So tap into God in you, God through you, and experience and watch what God will do in the ripple effect of your life. Mary, what is next for you? What is on the agenda? Is it just unfolding, or what's going on in the future?
I give up trying to predict what happens tomorrow.
Yeah, it's good.
I truly live in the moment. Mm. I plan, don't get me wrong. I'm not a live in the moment, forget about tomorrow.
Right.
I certainly plan for tomorrow, but I absolutely try the best I can to always be listening to where God is leading me.
Yeah. You know, audience out there, some of you are pastors, some of you have churches, some of you have influence, and you have an audience that can be inspired not only by the book, but having Mary come and speak at your event or you're at church. I really think it can be a real evangelical event because your story goes beyond a religious person who's now going to go and try to capture some more religious people. But your story is for real about a God who loves every person who's hearing this story and those who haven't yet. So we're just so thankful that we had the privilege to having you on our show. We know this is probably the first and second time now of more to come. And thank you so much for coming all this way to be with us.
Thank you. It's such a privilege. It really is.
Good to have you. Audience, thank you for being with us on The Converging Zone. We'll see you again soon.
I hope everybody enjoyed that. She's really a very remarkable person, and I do hope to have the opportunity to bring her down here again. At the beginning of the meeting, I told you there was one aspect of her experience that I found really unique, and what it was the fact that she had been told in her experience about the death of her son. I've heard thousands of near-death experiences in all the years that I've been involved, and quite honestly, that is the only time that I've ever heard that somebody was told in an experience of the impending loss of a child. I think the fact that Mary had that knowledge and that she went on to lead a very productive life and had an amazing relationship with her family is, you know, I think a testament to who she really is. For those of you that haven't read the book or haven't had the opportunity to get to know her, she had a very, very special relationship with all of her children, but especially her oldest son who died. And if memory serves me correctly, he was with another friend. They were walking along a country road. He was going to college back east, and he was hit and killed by a driver. But Mary went on to, in the conversations that we had, that she was really touched by how many people's lives her son's life had touched, that she was hearing from fellow students and people that had met and known him throughout his life. And so it goes back to what she was saying about the ripple effect. And so I do hope that you all enjoyed the message that she had, and that you know, this video was as special to you as it was to me. And if you have any questions, we'll certainly open the floor to that now.
On the video, the interviewer guy never actually asks her, well, how did your legs and all of the torn ligaments ever turn out? Do you have the slightest idea if she can walk, or did they have her just sitting the whole time because she's now in a wheelchair? It never really said.
No. As she indicated, they flew back to the States, and she went through a number of surgeries and was hospitalized for quite some time. She made reference to it at the beginning that she would never, ever recommend that. She had some really significant orthopedic injuries that should have been treated long before they were. And because of the delay and the fact that she had flown back to the States, there was some question whether the surgeries would be successful.
For those who might want to follow up, I know the book of To Heaven and Back is available, but she's also in later years thought more about her experience and has written up a follow-up book of lessons that she learned in heaven. And you can go to go to guideposts.org, and they have a special of selling both those books of Dr. Mary Neal through guideposts.org.
Thank you. We're going to go ahead and we'll end the formal aspect of our meeting.